Bureau-in-Chief warns that, quote, Afghanistan is spinning out of control, calling on the Taliban to immediately halt their offensive in the country. Immigration advocates censure the U.S. president's asylum policies, describing the expulsion of migrants at the Mexico border as cruel and unlawful. Also ahead, Venezuela's government and the opposition launch a new round of talks to end a years-long political and economic crisis. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the United Nations Secretary General has called on Taliban militants to immediately halt their offensive in Afghanistan.
I call on the Taliban to immediately halt the offensive and to negotiate in good faith in the interest of Afghanistan and its people. I hope that discussions in Doha, Qatar, between representatives of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the Taliban, supported by the region and the wider international community, will restore the best way to a negotiated settlement to the conflict.
Antonio Guterres warned that Afghanistan is spinning out of control. He told the reporters that seizing power through military force is a losing proposition that can only lead to prolonged civil war or to the complete isolation of the country. Guterres expressed concern about the early indications that the Taliban are imposing severe restrictions on human rights in the areas under their control. Guterres called on all parties to do more to protect civilians. And the Taliban have seized the southern Afghan city of Lashkar Gah, the capital of Helmand province, as they expand their control across the country. A security source said Lashkar Gah collapsed after military and government officials struck a deal with the militants and evacuated the city. The Taliban have seized 18 provincial capitals, including Afghanistan's second largest city of Kandahar. It is estimated that they now control nearly two-thirds of the country. Thousands of civilians have fled to the capital, Kabul, which has remained in the hands of the government. The U.S. says it is deploying thousands of troops to help evacuate their nationals and diplomats from Afghanistan.
And I expect that by the end of the weekend, the bulk of the 3,000 that we talked about yesterday will be in place. Probably not all, but the bulk. What we want to be able to do is to get there fast and get there capable. And be able to provide as much capacity to the State Department as we can. And our intention is to be able to move thousands per day.
The UK government also said a military operation is launched to help evacuate British nationals from Afghanistan. The UK Defence Ministry said it could also deploy military aircraft if required. Britain has also urged its nationals to leave Afghanistan immediately amid the worsening security situation. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the Taliban militant group will not be welcomed if it resorts to violence.
I would hope that the Taliban leadership would understand modernity requires sympathy, reconciliation, harmony, and that they are not going to be welcomed or appreciated by the rest of the world if they engage in this agenda of barbarism and like you said, 12-year-old girls being forced to marry and not being able to go to school, not being able to work. That's a terrible nightmare that's potentially could come upon the Afghanistan. But it has to be solved by the Afghani people, buttressed and supported by a superior and strong-willed countries like perhaps Iraq and Iran and perhaps some areas of China. Russia, I think, would have a role in that. But something has got to come in and stop their bloodlust and persuade them and win the hearts and minds of the Taliban that they're not going to succeed in an agenda of destruction. The only way they're going to succeed is with an agenda of harmonization and reconciliation and leaving people basic human fundamental rights so that they're not slaves just because they're women, or they're not worthy of being executed just because they use ice cubes or play soccer or listen to music.
The United States has imposed sanctions on an Omani national and several companies that Washington says are linked to Iran. The U.S. Treasury Department described the individual as an oil smuggler. It has also targeted four firms, two based in Oman, one Liberian, and another in Romania, citing their alleged support for Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The blacklisting freezes all the assets the people and firms have in the U.S. and bars American companies from doing business with them. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the United States froze an agreement on a humanitarian prisoner exchange between Tehran and London. Araghchi made the remarks in a post on his Twitter account, saying Washington has taken the detainees, quote, hostage for political goals. That's after British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab demanded the release of 10 prisoners, including Anousheh Ashoori. Ashoori is a British-Iranian dual national who was detained in August 2017. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison for cooperating with Israel's spy agency Mossad and 2 years for obtaining €33,000 in illicit funds nearly a year later. Iranians have reacted to the release of a photo of the Russian and British ambassadors in Tehran. In the next report, we will tell you why the picture has triggered an acrimonious backlash.
A controversial photo taken at the Russian embassy in Tehran has angered Iranians. The picture posted online by the Russian embassy this week has drawn widespread criticism and growing calls for an official apology. The controversial photo depicts Russian Ambassador Levan Jagarian and his British counterpart Simon Shercliffe sitting on the porch of the embassy with a third empty chair. It clearly echoes a photo taken in 1943 of Allied leaders Joseph Stalin, Winston Churchill, and U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt at exactly the same location. The Allied leaders met at the Tehran conference to coordinate strategy against Nazi Germany. At the time, Iran was occupied by Russian and British forces despite its neutrality in the Second World War. The 1943 conference at the Russian embassy is seen by many Iranians as a violation of Iran's sovereignty and independence. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif led a chorus of sharp criticism, describing the photo as, quote, extremely inappropriate. On Thursday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the British and Russian envoys over the release of the picture online. The envoys were told at the ministry that the posting was totally unacceptable. The Russian and British diplomats insist that no harm was intended and that the picture was a tribute to the fight against Nazi Germany.
The tweet posting the picture received a large number of angry replies. Some said the ambassadors are insulting all Iranians. Outgoing Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif criticized the posting, saying the Iranian people have shown that their destiny can never be subject to decisions in foreign embassies or by foreign powers.
Other Iranian officials and people were quick to denounce the photo. Iran's Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf censored the meeting between the Russian and UK ambassadors as, quote, inappropriate and inconsistent with diplomatic protocols, urging the foreign ministry to follow up on the case. Ghalibaf said both ambassadors must swiftly issue an official apology, otherwise firm diplomatic action will be necessary. Foreign Minister Designate Hossein Amir Abdullahian joined the chorus of critics on Thursday. The top diplomat said the picture, quote, showed disregard for diplomatic etiquette and the national pride of the Iranian people. Faced with widespread criticism, the Russian ambassador tweeted that the photo does not have any anti-Iranian context. The envoy said that he is not going to offend the feelings of the friendly Iranian people. The British ambassador retweeted his Russian counterpart's comments. The controversy triggered by the photo is still under the spotlight. Some observers believe an official apology could help end the controversy.
Immigration advocates have slammed the U.S. president for his administration's expulsion of migrants at the Mexican border and other deterrent measures. In a letter to Joe Biden, more than 100 organizations said the measures are, quote, cruel, unlawful, and ineffective. They called on the president to restore all migrants' ability to claim asylum in the U.S. and to avoid imposing any limits on asylum access. They said the Biden administration is apparently focused only on arrests and deportation and not the rights of asylum seekers. The advocates noted that Biden's policy absolutely contradicts his pledges of a humane approach to the matter. The U.S. president has adhered to his predecessor's policy of sending migrants caught crossing the border back to Mexico. This has pushed the border arrests up to 20-year highs in recent months. Venezuelan government and the opposition have launched a new round of talks to end a years-long political and economic crisis. The two sides are currently holding talks in Mexico. The sanctions against the Latin American nation and the issue of elections are on the agenda. The previous talks between the government and the opposition in 2019 and 2020 broke down with no results. Washington and several of its Western allies have backed opposition leader Juan Guaido and imposed crippling sanctions on Venezuela in a bid to oust President Nicolas Maduro. The government says it won't bow down to what it calls blackmail by the United States in the upcoming talks. Writer and activist Yamo Jabur says it's unlikely that the talks between the Venezuelan government and the opposition will yield any tangible results.
I believe it's going to be very hard to believe that if the United States will lift these sanctions, given the fact that the United States, what they want is to remove the presidency and the government of Nicolas Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution, because they want a U.S.-backed puppet that will protect their interests, their oil interests, given the fact that Venezuela is rich in oil. So it is very hard to think that the United States will lift these sanctions, but we have to be hopeful.
The United States has imposed fresh sanctions against Cuba, citing alleged human rights abuses. The U.S. Treasury Department added two Cuban Ministry of Interior officials and a unit of the Cuban Ministry of Revolutionary Armed Forces to its sanctions blacklist. That's the third round of U.S. measures against Cuba over the government's response to protests that took place on the island in July. Meanwhile, Cuba's Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez on Twitter rejected the sanctions, saying they are a sign of Washington's double standards policy.
I reject the U.S. opportunistic measures against Cuba's Ministry of Interior officers and Armed Forces prevention troops. Such measures reflect double standards of a government used to manipulation and lies to maintain the blockade against Cuba.
Rodriguez had previously denounced the protests as, quote, systemic provocation by U.S.-backed dissidents. Cuba was the scene of anti-government protests on July 11th and 12th over an ongoing economic crisis. Havana blames Washington's decades-long economic pressure, as well as COVID-19 pandemic, for the economic downturn. Political commentator Danny Shaw says the new round of sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Cuba will only cause more suffering.
All of these sanctions, it seems every day, every month, Biden, Trump, Obama, Bush, there's a new round of sanctions against the Cuban people and their fearless anti-imperialist leadership. It'll only cause more suffering, more separation between Cubans and their families. And that's exactly what they've been designed to do. And how cruel today, on the day that Fidel Castro would have been 95 years of age, arguably the most emblematic David versus Goliath figure, most important third world anti-imperialist figure of the 20th century, on his birthday today, they impose a new round of harsher, crueler sanctions. This does not represent the American people. Most of us have no idea how this impacts everyday Cuban families, but this represents the Marco Rubios, the Rick Scotts, and these other politicians and businessmen who want to recolonize and reconquer Cuba.
British police say they have identified the gunman who went on a shooting rampage in southwest England on Thursday evening, leaving five people dead. The police say the assailant was a 22-year-old troubled loner named Jake Davison. They have ruled out terrorism as a motive behind the worst mass shooting in over a decade. They say Davison had a family relationship with his first victim. According to police, Davison first killed a woman at her house in the port city of Plymouth, and then shot and killed a young girl and a man outside the house. The gunman then claimed the lives of a woman and a man who were nearby before killing himself. Police have also confirmed that Davison held a firearms license. Staying in the UK, which has recorded another 100 coronavirus deaths, driving its overall fatalities closer to 131,000, the country has the most number of COVID fatalities in Europe after Russia. On Friday, Britain also logged nearly 33,000 new infections, pushing the caseload to over 6.2 million. According to the Department of Health and Social Care, over 40 million Britons have been fully vaccinated so far. Despite the relatively large number of cases in the past couple of weeks, the British government has resisted calls to impose new restrictions. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
the limelight.
The remarks of the Chinese envoy to the UN that the United States is the biggest threat to peace and stability in the South China Sea, oh, not to be looked as a crisis pertaining to a particular geographical area. It is actually part of a grave problem plaguing the whole world in view of the fact that the United States is evil to its very core. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Keihan International. This article is published under the heading, "The United States, the Stabilizing Factor All Over the World." Stay tuned for more. The remarks of the Chinese envoy to the UN that the United States is the biggest threat to peace and stability in the South China Sea ought not to be looked as a crisis pertaining to a particular geographical area. It is actually part of a grave problem plaguing the whole world in view of the fact that the United States is evil to its very core. It is the stabilizing factor all over the globe and the enemy of all nations. What China's Deputy UN Ambassador Dai Bing said in his heated spat with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the UN Security Council in New York rings true all over the world. He rightly remarked that Washington is stirring up trouble out of nothing, arbitrarily sending advanced military vessels and aircraft into the South China Sea as provocations and publicly trying to drive a wedge between regional countries. We are witnessing this same destabilizing policy of the United States in the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Oman, the Red Sea, and throughout West Asia. In addition to the mess the American occupation forces have created in the landlocked South Asian country of Afghanistan, where blood continues to flow like water. Almost on a daily basis, there are acts of provocation by intruding U.S. naval forces in and around the strategic Hormuz Strait, similar to what the Americans are doing in South China Sea, including the Taiwan Strait. But for the illegal U.S. presence and support for ruthless and unrepresentative regimes, especially the illegal Zionist entity as well as terrorists of all hue and color, Syria would not have been plagued for the past 11 years by the macabrely murderous Takfiris, who have killed over 500,000 people and displaced millions of others, besides destroying entire towns and cities. Post-Baathist Iraq today would have been a sovereign, independent, strong, and rich country today, but for the unwarranted presence of the criminal Yankees, who continue to terrorize the Iraqi people besides draining their oil wealth. Yemen would have been spared of an imposed war and the destruction the U.S. proxies have wrought on the Arab world's poorest country over the past 6 years, by massacring over 250,000 men, women, and children, and destroying the infrastructure. If not for the unwanted presence of the U.S. Fifth Fleet in Manama, and support for the repressive Al Khalifa minority regime, Bahrain would have long become a democratic state. In the Levant, Lebanon would not have been embroiled in a financial crisis, and Palestinians would have liberated their entire homeland, including Beit al-Muqaddas and Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque. As for the Islamic Republic of Iran, it would not have been the prime victim of American economic, political, cultural, medical, and media terrorism for the past four decades. The United States is also the villain of the peace throughout Latin America, where it supports dictatorial regimes and undermines the sovereignty of legally elected governments in order to keep its stranglehold on the rich natural resources. And the same exploitative policies pursued by Washington in Africa, where people are forced to live a life of subhumans, with no hope to ever rid of the continent's backwardness in spite of its abundant resources. Last but not the least, the United States is definitely not a friend of the people of Europe, who since the end of the Second World War have to bear the burden of American hegemony in military bases, equipped with dangerous nuclear warheads for continuation of the unnecessary Cold War confrontation with Russia. The other day, the Russian embassy in Washington shed light on part of the U.S. mischief all over the world when it said U.S. military forces deployed to the oil-rich northeastern part of Syria have no legal mandate to stay in the West Asian country under the allegations of fighting the Takfiri Daesh terrorist group. In a post published on his Twitter page in answer to a U.S. military spokesman's claim that American forces are in northeastern Syria under international law, UN Security Council Resolution 2254, adopted December 2015, the Russian embassy pointed out, "It's a matter of fact that the U.S. armed forces have no legal mandate to stay in Syria. Your interpretation of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2254 is just ridiculous. Please read the document thoroughly."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and we now present you from the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, a beautiful piece of supplication to God. O Allah, exalted is your station, great is your power, and stupendous your might. You have no need of the creatures. Your supremacy is all-embracing, and you have the power to do whatever you wish. Your mercy is near, your promise is true, your blessings are plenteous, and your tests are beautiful.
English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seven, barometric pressure.
I come to you, and oh God, name that thou art our only king.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. My condolences to the entire Muslim Ummah on this, rather we being in the blessed and the sacred and the sad month of Muharram. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He enables us to truly benefit from this month and, you know, begin a revolution within ourselves because of the sacrifice of Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi wasalam. For that was the crux of the Imam's mission, or one of the main important points of the Imam's mission. As I mentioned before, the Imam's mission is so multifaceted that it is not possible to just pinpoint one thing and say, "Oh, this is exactly what the Imam alayhi salam meant to do." No. The Imam's existence, or rather the capacity of the Imam's existence, was such that he was able to intend, unlike us, we're only able to intend one thing. But according to the mystics and the great scholars, the Imam's si'a al-wujud, or that vastness of his existence, enabled him to do, or rather aim, with one action, many different things. And alhamdulillah, we see in the world today that this was something that occurred. And therefore, it is seen that the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is a book that kind of dwells into the subject from the teachings of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, from the Holy Quran. And it's a book that is meant to kind of guide us towards this inner revolution by using the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, by using Imam Hussein alayhi salam as a role model in order to facilitate for this internal revolution. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be introducing this book to our dear listeners. Please stay tuned.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd. Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. Are no clouds are hidden behind these faces? Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats in chanty whisper. Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name? Say, is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. Again, my sincere condolences to all the Muslims, rather all of mankind, in this the blessed month of Muharram. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listenership is titled From Resolution to Revolution, The Message of Ashura. This book was authored by Sayyid Mustafa Al-Kazwini, and was published by the Islamic Educational Center of Orange County, which is in the United States of America. The author himself mentions about this book that it is a set of lectures that was given in London, and therefore it was structured in a way in which it will assist the youth of the contemporary times. And he mentions this, and he says that our youth are struggling with their identity and their religiosity, especially where in the West. Thus, the present work is a gift wrapped up in the form of lessons taken out of sermons that were delivered over a period of 3 years in London. So the book is structured in three parts. And within each part, there are certain subheadings and certain discussions that take place. And these discussions begin usually with a verse from the glorious Quran, in which the author then continues and attempts to explain it by focusing on obviously this type of, you know, turning away from the demonic kind of system and turning towards the divine system of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore it shows that the series that the author has given, or the Sayyid has given, reflects a number of spiritual, social, and individual struggles that resonate within every person, and further seek to provide spiritual direction to those challenges. And since the lectures were inspired by the character and sacrifice of the grandson of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, whose life was taken in the midst of his prime years, it's not really true because the Imam was in his 50s when he passed away. So it was the, you know, the older side of the Imam's life, highlighting the years of youth, in particular Muslim youth living in the West, will predominate most of the themes throughout the book. So he's basically saying that this book has been written for the youth in order to give them direction in this topic that have been mentioned. Inshallah, please don't go away and stay with us until our next segment. Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced today, or in this episode, is titled From Resolution to Revolution, a set of lectures that have been composed in a book by Sayyid Mustafa Al-Kazwini, a resident scholar in the United States of America, which is based upon a set of lectures that was given over a three-year period in the city of London in England, the United Kingdom. So a part of this book reads, The Spirit of Ashura. And as we mentioned, he begins with a verse of the Holy Quran, A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. We will just read the English. Indeed, God has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. They fight in the way of God, kill and are killed. A promise binding upon him in the Torah and the Injil, Gospel, and the Quran. And who is truer to his promise than God? So rejoice in the bargain you have made with him, and that is the great success. The eve of Ashura is a very solemn night for many Muslims worldwide. We begin to recall the events of that evening up until the next day. Immediately grief strikes the heart upon hearing the story. Without compulsion, one joins a wave of mourners remembering the life and sacrifice of Imam Hussein, his family, and his companions. And we all remember them in sadness. On this night, we share our sympathy with the Ahlul Bayt and their grandfather, the Prophet, who is cited by Bukhari as saying that the Prophet held Hussein in his arms and said, Hussein is from me, and I am from Hussein. May God love whoever loves Hussein. Whoever shares in the sorrow of Imam Hussein is beloved in the eyes of God. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to in this month make us of the true mourners of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Inshallah, until our next episode. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
The light.
After an epic 17-month journey that drew international attention, China's famous herd of wandering elephants has finally returned home. Wildlife protection officials said the elephants safely crossed the bridge over the Yuan River to reach their protected habitat. The Asian elephants also received a little encouragement from wildlife rangers to help them get home. Staff used corn trails as bait and built artificial roads to ensure the herd took the right route. The 1,300-kilometer odyssey that began in March captivated audiences with several highlights. One of the highlights was the birth of a calf in November. In June, drone footage was captured of the 14-member herd as they were sleeping outside of a village. In Indonesia, a group of university lecturers have come up with an idea of building a robot to help people during the coronavirus pandemic. The robot is assembled from electric household items like pots and pans and an old television monitor. It was named Delta after the new coronavirus variant ripped through Indonesia. The robot was initially built to entertain residents of a village in the country's East Java province. But the head of the robot-making project says he decided to shift his function into assisting people dealing with a deadly virus.
With this new Delta variant and the surging number of COVID-19 cases, I decided to turn the robot used for public services into one that sprays disinfectant and delivers food and necessities of residents who are self-isolating. I'm shifting the function to serve only the members of the community who are in need.
The interesting thing about a robot is that it greets people when delivering things to isolated residents. The developers of the robot say it has been built in a joint project with local people and is by no means a high-tech device. The world's oldest wooden boat belonging to Egyptian pharaoh King Khufu has been moved to its new home in a painstaking transfer process. It took 48 hours to move the 20-ton vessel to the Grand Egyptian Museum from the Giza pyramids. It was carefully fixed inside a metal cage and carried on a remote-controlled vehicle. The 4,600-year-old vessel, also known as Solar Boat, was not built to sail through seas. In ancient Egypt, pharaohs commissioned solar boats, which were essentially virtual vessels to transport them to the afterlife. To fulfill their purpose, they were buried in pits next to royal burial chambers. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain proved that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This non-figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Fatik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of Batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now a skillful artist in her workshop who designed colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Karamus in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, the industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artists to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We made products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. You can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four of her houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea, and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewy, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days, recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is considering deploying more recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and were able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tipped sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of two baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost eight of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst the wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number two.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. The massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabby and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabby hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabby's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful. The Tabby is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program.